Happy Father's Day, everyone. My name is Matt. It's great to see you all. We are continuing our series we're doing this month on the life of Moses. And this morning, I'm drawing from a book by a guy named Jeff Mannion called The Land Between. And so I'm making use of that metaphor and application, and I want to give him credit for that. One of my favorite authors, another note, is a guy named Ernest Hemingway. You may have heard of him. He's got a bunch of short stories, and one of his short stories is called The Battler. And in it, there's a young guy named Nick who is hitching a ride on a train. And the brakeman catches him, like, you know, stole away on the train car, and says, "Hey, come here, kid, I got something for you." And Nick walks over to him, and then before you know it, the guy's thrown him off of the train in the middle of the night while it's still moving. And it says this, kind of he gathers himself. It says, Nick rubbed his eye. There was a big bump coming up. He knew he would have a black eye, all right. It ached already. He felt his knee. The pants were torn and his skin was barked. His hands were scraped and there were sand and cinders driven up under his nails. He went over to the edge of the track, down the little slope to the water, and washed his hands. He washed them carefully in the cold water, getting the dirt out from the nails. He squatted down and bathed his knee. It was dark and he was a long way from anywhere. He wiped his hands on his trousers and stood up, then climbed the embankment to the rails. Nick walked along. He must get to somewhere. We probably all know people who were cruising along through life, and then with like one conversation, found themselves bruised and scraped up and in the middle of nowhere going, "How did I get here? All I know is I can't go back to where I came from, and I don't know what's ahead." For some of us, it comes with a single conversation that changes everything. Your department no longer exists. Your position has been eliminated. Or there's been an accident, that call that comes in the middle of the night. We think grandpa's had a stroke. How quickly can you make it to the hospital? All of a sudden, life changes. Or, "I don't love you anymore. The engagement's off." Or, "Your mom and I are divorcing." And you're thrown. You find yourself in the world of the unemployed or the world of the suddenly single. I mean, the last thing you knew, you were cruising along. And then everything changed. Sometimes it's not just a single event. It takes place over years, kind of the slow erosion of time. For example, over months and years, the heart of your teenage son or daughter begins to drift more and more from you or from God. And you look at that family photo when she's like 10, and you're like, there's so much joy, and she looks so happy. And now at 17, it seems like that's gone, and there's like this bitterness, and there's this resentment. You look at that picture and you think, "Where did my baby go?" Of course, it didn't happen overnight. It was a slow erosion of time. Or a marriage suffers over a dozen years or so until someone finally walks. I mean, whether we enter into this land in a single conversation or whether we do it over time, we all know what it means to be in the space, the land between. And I want you to think about the fact that all of us listening today have either been in a place like that, or we are right now, or we will be. None of us escape this. Things going wrong, sometimes tragically wrong. So if you're here today and you find yourself in the land between, and I would guess it'd be several of us in this room, I want to show you a picture, actually a map, because there's a place on the map where we can find ourselves, and I think it helps bring some context and some insights to what we're experiencing. So I'm going to start in Exodus chapter 13, and I want to give you a brief history first and where we are in the story of Moses. So God had promised the Israelites that one day they would have a land of their own, the promised land. The problem is, for centuries, they had been slaves in a place called, anybody know? Egypt. You've been paying attention. For generations, they never got to the land God promised Abraham. And here it is on a map, just to help you visualize what's going on here. This part in the middle, that stretch of land, is called the Sinai Peninsula. And from the satellite, you can see this part just right here. Is that a rainforest? No, that wasn't a trick question. It's not. It's like dry, barren. It's a desert. There's not a lot of life. There's not a lot of green or growth. Over here, where it's definitely green, that is the Nile Delta region. That's Egypt. That's also the land of slavery. But things grow there. There's life. There's abundance. There's vegetation, fish, and crops. And then up here to the right, where it's also green, that is the Promised Land. That's modern-day Israel, modern-day Palestine. And you can see there that stuff grows there. There's life. There's abundance. God says it's a land flowing with milk and honey. Even better, here, there would be no slavery. So I just want us to see this map. Last week, we talked about how God comes to a shepherd named Abraham, or named Moses. We're talking about Moses. Comes to a guy named Moses who's wandering around as a shepherd in the Sinai Peninsula for 40 years, and God says, I've seen my people in Egypt. I've seen their hardship. I've heard their groans. I've heard about their suffering, and I just want you to know that I am concerned. And then there's that famous line in Exodus where God says, I will lead your people. I will lead the people out of a land of slavery and into the Promised Land, the land of your forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so that's all good news, and it's all things to celebrate. So the great thing is God is going to take them, I think, from green space to green space. Isn't that great? I say, perfect. Let's go. Sign me up. When do we get started? And nothing is said at all about the land between, which is going to come up. And they're going to find out. So Moses goes back to Egypt. You know the story. He goes to Pharaoh. He says, let my people go. And if you've seen one of the movies, the Prince of Egypt or the Gods and Kings or the, okay, Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, you go, okay, you know what I'm talking about. Pharaoh goes, Moses says, let my people go. And Pharaoh goes, no, I'm not doing that. And so God sends the plagues, and there's all these miraculous supernatural things that happen, wears Pharaoh down and the people. Finally, Pharaoh relents. He says, okay, you can leave. In fact, get out of here. And their exodus out of Egypt begins. Exodus 13, verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God, notice these details. God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. Time out. Is that the quickest way? No, he says, you're definitely not going the quickest way. From the very beginning, God, it seems, decides to take them on the long way around. So on the detour, the scenic route. And it says he leads them by this desert road toward the Red Sea, which is just foreshadowing about what's to come for the Israelites. They get to the Red Sea, somewhere down here, which if you're trying to go here, this would be like the first obstacle I would try to avoid. It's in the south. It's not even on the way to the Promised Land. And they get there, and they find out that Pharaoh changed his mind, and he actually decided, wait a minute, who's going to build my summer palace? Sends his whole army, chariots and soldiers after him. They have their backs to the Red Sea. They have no options. They have no boats. There's like a couple hundred thousand of them anyway. So all this is happening, Exodus 14. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. Verse 11, they said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. First of all, isn't it amazing how quickly the people forget? Like they witnessed the events of the Passover. They saw the miraculous plagues against Egypt. And here they are, days later, weeks later, like it never happened. And they start to panic, and they're freaking out, and they're blaming Moses. Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid, stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." And Moses steps into the water with this wooden staff, and he puts it down into the water, and miraculously, I mean, it's an unbelievable story. The waters of the Red Sea part in two, and the entire Israelite community walks across the Red Sea on dry ground. And I imagine they're probably thinking, "Oh, God has been so faithful. How quickly we forget. Why did we even doubt? I mean, we're almost there. After all these years, we're getting close to the promised land." After they crossed the Red Sea, Exodus 14:31 says, "And when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant." And the really good news is, from this point on, the people never lose faith. They never complain to God or to Moses when things aren't going right. Like, they had finally seen enough to fully place their trust in God and never question again. Sadly, and you know how the story goes, that is not what happens. Now, what they don't realize yet in this moment, after they cross the Red Sea, is that their time in the wilderness is actually just beginning. They are about to spend 40 years wandering around the Sinai Peninsula. Do you realize it's only about 240 miles from Egypt to Canaan? Not that far, is it? It'd be like walking from Muncie to Evansville. 240, not easy, but doable. Can you imagine that taking 40 years? Can you imagine putting in Google, like, you know how it gives you the different times? Do you have a 40-year? Yeah, it's crazy. Really quick side note, and I probably shouldn't tell you guys this because you're going to worry about me, but back in late October, I had this idea where I wanted to try to walk, to see if I could walk from my house in Yorktown to Richmond. I don't know, it just seemed like a good idea. And so I tried it, and I also decided maybe the time would go faster if I just walked all night instead of in the daytime. I don't know why. On the greenway that follows 35, you know. First of all, it's a long way from my house to the start of that trail. And that took a long time just to get there. Long story short, I did not make it, okay? If you must know, I bought new shoes that I'd never worn before, so that was probably mistake number one, which I knew, but it was better than the alternative, I felt like. So about 3 o'clock in the morning, I had to call. I didn't tell very many people because, again, they would institutionalize me. But anyway, I called Jeremy, at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was in LeSantville, which is still not bad. It's like 26 miles away, so I still did pretty good. But I had, my feet were like bleeding, I had blisters, and I couldn't, that last few miles. Anyway, Jeremy very kindly picked me up, and we try not to talk about it to this day. But anyway, so someday, you'll hear more, and maybe next time I'll try to go to Evansville. That's my point. Now, you look at this image, and you ask the question, what did all of those people eat for 40 years? It's a great question, and I'm glad that you brought that up. So the people get hungry, obviously, and they start complaining in verse 3 of Exodus 16. "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us out into the desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Well, God provided a food substance. Does anybody know what it was called? If you had Sunday school at all, right? Yeah. Manna. And I don't know if you know this, but manna is actually the Hebrew word meaning, what is it? What is this stuff? That's what it is. Morning, every morning, this dew would fall on the ground. There would be this weird stuff on the ground. They would collect it, and they'd be like, what is it? And that's how it got its name. The manna was like coriander seed and looked like resin. The people went around gathering it and then ground it in a handmill or crushed it in a mortar. They cooked it in a pot or made it into loaves. And so apparently they would add water to it. They'd boil it. I'm thinking like oatmeal, but I don't know. Or they'd bake it into cakes, or they'd broil it, or they'd fry it, or they'd, what's that scene from Forrest Gump? All those things to it. So obviously it's not long before they're sick of this, what is it, manna stuff. Numbers 11, the rabble with them began to crave other food, and again the Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost, also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. And I read that, and I think about all they experienced, and I think, boy, quit complaining. Like, you're being kind of babies. I think about, like, when our kids were younger, and I'd say, and they were whining, and I would say, I can't hear you when you're whining, which is actually a lie. I can't hear you when you're whining. You want to try again? But I just want to kind of pause here, because when we come to places like this in Scripture where people aren't at their best, rather than putting ourselves like above them, like I could never be like this, it's probably healthier and probably more accurate to see ourselves alongside them, among them, to say, given the right circumstances, I for sure would be losing it too. Did any of you here ever pass through a season of your life where money was tight and there was a shortage? Maybe when you were at college, maybe first starting out, perhaps for some of us like last week. And in this particular season, you found yourselves eating the same food over and over because it was cheap. Let me refresh your memory. These are ramen noodles, and I don't know what it is now, because I kind of loaded like this, but you used to be able to get five for like a dollar, and they're really not that bad, if you don't have to eat them every single day. Have some of you not come to loathe the taste, the texture, the crinkling of the paper itself? The package. I mean, imagine this, breakfast, lunch, and dinner every single day for decades. And you begin to get a sense of where they are. Exodus 16:35 has this almost like an offhanded sentence. He says, the Israelites ate manna 40 years until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. So yeah, they're going, we're sick of this. As Jeff Mannion says, we may think that nothing grows in the desert, but make no mistake, the land between is fertile ground for complaint. Yeah. Now again, before we move on, perhaps we can see ourselves in this if we hang with this for a moment. Maybe we're not so different than they are, given for each of us the right circumstances or the wrong ones, we could easily be in a similar place. I mean, we've all said, I'm sick of this, haven't we? We've all said, I'm sick of getting to the end of the month and having to decide which bills I'm going to pay and which ones I'm not going to pay. Or I'm sick of sending out resumes. I'm tired of being asked what line of work I'm in and having to fumble for an answer. Or how about this? I'm sick of visiting a parent in a nursing home and having to explain who I am because they constantly ask. Or I'm sick of going to medical test after test and still no diagnosis. I'm sick of this manna. And so I think it's helpful just to acknowledge that in the land between for all of us, complaint comes very naturally. That you actually have to guard your heart and your mind against the spirit of complaint. I think about the Israelites complaining, and there's a part of me that goes, all right, I mean, how serious can it be? They're just complaining about food. So what's the big deal? And it turns out, in their case, it's actually a very big deal. In their complaining about the manna, so they say to Moses, we remember we had all this food back in Egypt, and now we only have this stuff. There's something in their spirits that's basically saying, we were better off as slaves in Egypt. Which means what they're really saying is, God, we got together and we kind of think we were better off without you. And so they're getting dangerously close to something bordering on treason against God. And so when they're complaining about the food, it's not like they're complaining about cafeteria food. No big deal. They're essentially saying, God, we wish you had never gotten involved in our lives. In fact, at one point, they start a movement. They start talking about maybe we can find a new leader and they'll take us back to Egypt. Sorry, God, thanks for everything, but we're going to see if Egypt will take us back. Moses, by the way, in the context of all this, has a complete meltdown. He just goes, I can't take it anymore. And he goes to God. He says, this is too much for me to carry. I can't deal with this. Now, here's an important question. What are they doing there, circling the Sinai Peninsula over and over for all those years? Why was that wilderness experience necessary for them? Or was it? Or was it just a pointless detour and there was no purpose? If we look at this map again, you realize, of course, when they leave Egypt, that they're not very well organized. It is like this mob of people. And by the way, they've been indoctrinated for generations with an Egyptian worldview. And so all they've ever known is to worship these Egyptian gods and goddesses. And where are they headed? So all they know is idol worship. They're headed to Canaan, which is a land also dotted with idols and to Baal and to other fertility gods and goddesses. And the whole point when they get there is God saying, I want you to reflect me. I want you to be a light to the people around you. So that's like a really big task to go from having no knowledge, no awareness of God to somehow being formed into the people of God and to have enough strength and enough substance to be the light that God is calling them to be when they get there. And God is saying, listen, be very careful, because when you get to this promised land and you have a first bad season, the crops don't do very well, how quickly are you guys going to bail and offer sacrifices to Baal and how quickly are you going to abandon me when you're desperate and turn to the idols and the gods in that land? See, the land between, as challenging as it was for them, as much as they didn't want to be there, it was a place where God was transforming them to be his people. Which means, and this is the part that they continually fail to grasp, God actually has them in the desert for a reason. He's trying to form something within them. And I think a big part of what we're talking about is trust, which would be the glue that holds any relationship together. And as they leave Egypt, as they move toward the promised land, I think God is whispering to them again and again, will you trust me? Will you trust me? And unfortunately, they keep responding, no. No, we won't. And so it's not going very well. If you just step back and you see the kind of big picture here, one of the first dilemmas when they leave Egypt that they encounter, as I said, was the Red Sea. Pharaoh's army advancing against them in Exodus 14. They've got their back to the sea, no weapons. Well, Moses has a stick, okay? And God's saying, when you have your back to the sea and the enemy's approaching and you have no hope for escape, will you trust me? And they're going, God, this is not a good time to be asking this. We got our hands full. Moses, why did you bring us out here to be slaughtered? Well, of course, they crossed the Red Sea. Miraculously, God provides. 3 days into the desert and they're out of water, which is a huge problem. And the clock is ticking. They've got no options. In Exodus 15, they finally get to water, but it's undrinkable. It's really bitter. And they complain against Moses. And God says, I don't know if you noticed that whole thing where the Red Sea, I don't know if you remember this part where the Red Sea parted and you walked across on dry land. which is kind of a big deal. So when you run out of water, will you trust me? Nope, we won't. And they complain and they grumble, and God provides them with water. Pretty soon, they're out of food. And their response in Exodus 16 is, if only we had died in Egypt, or maybe we can get somebody to take us back. And God gives them the what is it? The manna. In Exodus 17, there's another water shortage, and the people again complain, and they're thirsty, and they're grumbling against Moses. Are you seeing a pattern? And what does God do? He provides for them water again. So by the time we get to Numbers 11, and they're complaining and complaining about the manna, this meal that they have to eat over and over. The point is, that's actually not the first time they've complained. It's not their first offense. Round after round, God is going, when you get attacked, will you trust me? When you need food, will you trust that I'll provide? When you need water, will you trust me? By the way, that last water incident, God commands Moses to take his staff and to strike a rock, and water flows out of a rock. What is that? I would say that's something from nothing. That's pretty much as close to like life from death as you can get. The lesson that God is trying to teach them is, do you believe I can bring something out of nothing? Do you believe that I can actually provide for you out of thin air is the lesson. And so as I read through Exodus 14, 15, 16, 17, I mean, again and again, God delivers, God rescues, God provides, God shows up. The very events in their lives that were supposed to grow their trust, all it does for them is grows complaining. And so by the time we get to their whining in Numbers 11, where we're tired of this manna and we want a new leader to take us back to Egypt. By the way, that's proof that just because large numbers of people believe something doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing. But they've been in the desert for close to 2 years at this point, and they're getting a big fat F in trust school. God is attempting to transform them into a people of trust, and they just keep going, no way, that's not happening. I just want to pause here for a second. Here's the question for us. What if that very event, that very circumstance in your life that you most detest, that you can't stand it, like you loathe it, it's a thing that you hate. What if that is actually also the very thing that God may want to use to bring growth? What if the space that you and I detest, this land between, you can see green space behind you. You know how it used to be. You're not going back there. You're hoping there's some green space up ahead, but you don't know. What if it's the place God actually wants to shape you in this season? Because the land between, this, by the way, is the place where we learn to pray. It's the place where we finally get to the end of ourselves. Like, God, I got to have you here because I am so lost right now. I am beyond my own resources. Or God, in this land between, I don't have peace. I don't have patience right now. I don't have a sense of joy. So God, I need you badly. Have you ever been in a place like that? The land between, it's a place for trust to grow. I want to look at this verse again as we close. It's interesting that you can read this verse in two completely different ways. The Israelites ate manna 40 years until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. So one way of reading that is kind of like the Israelites demonstrated with their attitude, their grumbling. I'm so sick of this. 40 years, day in, day out, same thing. Things were better when we were back in Egypt. Just kill us now. So that's one perspective. What's the other way of looking at that? The other way of reading that, I think probably more from God's perspective, is going, every day without fail. For 40 years, God showed up. And God provided for you again and again. You never had to worry about food. You went to bed, you woke up, you had food for the day. I provided for you out of nothing. Will you trust me? Again, one way for all of us, one way of interpreting our time in the land between is, oh, this is 40 years of nothing. This is 40 years of pointlessness, of waste. Or you can look at it the way God does. In Deuteronomy 8, remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the wilderness these 40 years to humble and test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands. He humbled you, causing you to hunger, and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your ancestors had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Your clothes did not wear out. Your feet did not swell during these 40 years. God's saying, I had a purpose for you in the land between. Could you not see that I was trying to accomplish something in your life that I really couldn't accomplish any other way? That I was leading you the whole time. And by the way, did anybody happen to notice that for this entire 40 years, you had like one pair of shoes? Your sandals never broke. You never got holes in your jeans. It's about trust. And I think for us, it's about choices. It's about choices of the heart when we find ourselves. And if we're not here now, we will be someday, again, in the land between. It's a place where trust can grow. It's also a place where faith can die. So whenever you enter into a season, whenever you have these choices before you, you get to decide who you're becoming, whether or not we become angry, bitter, fearful people. Like the choices of the heart that you make when you're 25 and the engagement gets broken off will affect who you become when you're 35, 40. The choice you make at 45 when your career stalls out, that's transforming your heart. That's actually shaping who you become later in life, in your 50s, in your 60s. Here's what we know for sure. We don't get to choose largely what happens to us. You did not get to choose what a distracted motorist does. You can't choose largely what happens to your body. We can't control the economy. In many, many ways, we don't get to choose what happens to us. We do get to choose our response. We actually do get to decide how we respond in these moments in the land between. I think what often happens for many of us is we have made the same choice over and over for so long now. We've actually conditioned ourselves to believing we don't have a choice when we're in the wilderness. In other words, we just reflexively choose anger or resentment or bitterness, because that's the track, that's the road that we keep walking, and that's the groove that we've worn. We automatically, you know, shut down, and we don't pick up the phone, we don't reach out to friends. Well, that shutting down is actually a choice. For others of us, when things are out of control, our heart goes to, if we're honest, it goes to envy. And why did they get that? Why them and not us? Listen, again, you don't get to choose often what happens. We do get to choose our response. James in the New Testament says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance." Consider it, can you believe he says that? The audacity. Pure joy. Huh? He's saying when you face trials, choose joy. The fact that that's actually a choice means it's a choice, one choice of many available. So choose, as in it's up to you, joy. It's a uniquely Christian response based in the belief that God is wise, that God is good, that somewhere downstream, even if we're in the desert right now and we don't know that there's green space up ahead, that somewhere downstream, God can redeem all of this? What if the soil that you most detest, resent, want to get out of, what if in your pain and in your confusion, what if we were to allow that to produce faith in us that we didn't even know was possible? God, I'm sick of this. And that's okay to say. By the way, what makes Moses different than the people is the people just complain to everybody else. Moses, when he's overwhelmed, he goes to God. And so we can say, God, I'm sick of this, but I'm going to trust that you see what I'm going through. I'm going to trust that you hear my complaint, that you see my, hear my groaning, and that you care. And so we can choose day after day. We have a choice. And so for those of us in this room that are in the middle, in the land between, may our gracious God restore your joy. May he give you patience and perseverance to endure another day, another week in your difficulty. May he give you laughter. May you be able to count your blessings even in a really, really tough stretch. And may God meet you with power and grace, even in, or especially in, the land between. Would you stand with me and we'll pray? Heavenly Father, for those of us who find ourselves today in a bit of a wilderness, in a bit of a dry place, the land between, Lord, whether we got here seemingly overnight or whether it took a long time, but we're here. God, help us in this moment to trust that we actually do have a choice. Have a choice about the kinds of people we are, the kinds of people we're becoming. Lord, help us to choose to trust that you can provide, even in the season that you will. That, Father, you can provide out of thin air, water from a rock. So, God, I ask that you would meet our needs, that you would carry us through to the other side. And, Lord, help us, maybe it's months from now or years from now, looking back on this chapter of our story, to be able to say, I am so glad I held on. I'm so glad I continued to trust. Lord, help us to be able to tell that story. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, thanks everyone for being here, worshiping with us. Happy Father's Day again. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time.